investigative reporting is journalism that goes very deep on a particular topic, and it seeks to uncover the truth about that topic or issue. It's often focused on a systems failure or some type of government, corporate, some type of wrongdoing that is happening. And reporters at all levels can pursue investigative reporting. But I think investigative journalism differs from other types of journalism in that it zooms out and tries to see the big picture. It's slower. We just finished a podcast at CPI called The Heist. It's a 5-episode podcast, and it is focused on Black farmers and the long documented history of discrimination that they've faced with the Department of Agriculture.
That's April Simpson, senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. If you're a journalism major or perhaps thinking about becoming one, this episode is for you. I'm telling you, we cover a lot of territory. We discuss April's journey, the nature of investigative journalism, The Heist, which is her podcast about Black farmers. She gives some advice for journalism students, and we talk about how she brings a story to life. Throughout the conversation, she reflects on the significance of mentorship and the need to stay true to one's passion in the field of journalism.
This is the Academic Survival Podcast, and I'm your host, Dr. Chandra McDonald. Statistics show that approximately 40% of students drop out of college every year. In fact, nearly 30% drop out their first year. Well, I am on a mission to improve these stats.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of Academic Survival. Today, I have with me April Simpson, and she is the senior reporter covering racial equity at the Center for Public Integrity. So, April, welcome to Academic Survival. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Yes. So I am excited for this interview to, for one, just like getting to know your background and the ways in which other students who are traveling down this same journey might be able to learn from your experiences and the things that you're doing these days with your degree. So let's dive right in. My first question is, like, where did you go to school? What college did you go to, and where is it located?
So I went to Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is in Western Massachusetts. And I studied American Studies and Government. I double majored there. But I actually started my college career at the University of Florida. I went there my first year of college and studied journalism and then transferred to Smith as a sophomore.
How many majors did you have?
I ended up at Smith with 2 majors, American Studies and Government.
American Studies and then also Government, you said? And then what like inspired you to become a reporter? How did you go from American Studies and Government to ending up being a reporter?
Well, okay. It started much earlier. We moved to Florida when I was 11 years old, and we moved from Yonkers, New York to small town Florida. And that was like huge culture shock for me. And in high school, I had a teacher, we actually had a broadcast journalism program, and that teacher suggested I take the print journalism class because I always loved writing. And that was where I felt like I finally found my stride. I found my place there. It felt like I could ask people questions about this kind of strange place that I found myself in and come to a greater understanding of it. So I knew from high school that I wanted to do journalism. And I decided ultimately to go to Smith, which didn't have a journalism program, because I really wanted to, at that point, get out of Florida. I was always committed to leaving.
Was it because of the culture shock?
It was, in large part, yes.
Okay.
It was, I mean, in New York, where we lived, was very racially diverse. And then when we moved to Florida, it was, you know, Black or white and very much segregated. And I just wasn't, you know, also just small, didn't have same access to transportation. And I just never got used to that. I always wanted to leave. And I was very fortunate that Smith gave me a very generous financial aid package and enabled that to happen.
You decided that you wanted to go into journalism, and that's exactly what you did. Is it at all what you expected it to be?
Yes and no. I think yes, in that the core of writing and reporting doesn't change, regardless of how much the industry has changed. So, you know, you're still interviewing, you're still having to report and get out in the field and access data and documents and so on. But the time that I started college, got out of college, and had my first few years of journalism changed so rapidly with an online.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, those things, I'm like an elder millennial, those things were not as, you know, they were not a part of your job, you know, to the extent that they are, they're core to your job now. And I didn't quite expect that when I first decided early college that journalism was it for me. You know, the stories have become more participatory and we're really thinking more about the community and working with in partnership with the audience rather than talking at them. And that's a change that, you know, was unexpected.
I like that partnership with the audience. I have not heard that expression before, but I like that. So someone who's majoring in journalism today, I mean, and like you said, this change in technology is altered as far as what you expected. And then now, like, we're dealing with AI. So it seems like there may even be another technological shift coming within journalism, perhaps. So from your perspective, like, what should journalism majors be prepared for?
I think students and young people are really adept at seeing the future in a way that elders may not be. So I think that young people can tell, you know, they can tell us like the directions in some ways that media is going. You know, for example, I mean, this is super old, but like blogging was a thing that I think kind of was very grassroots that journalists, I don't think, you know, capital J journalists didn't fully appreciate
right.
back then when that was something that was coming up. And I think the same thing can be said for social media. And now, like you said, AI. And I don't know, I think young people can probably tell us how AI can become more integrated into our work and how it can make us more efficient and productive.
Yeah, I'm thinking about, you know, you said journalism and like big J journalism. I'm also thinking about how there's other fields that's kind of been impacted the same way. So like, for example, there's so many people who are coaching these days, and yet like mental health professionals that's like how they were trained. They've got a whole different set of guidelines that they have to abide by when it comes to, quote, coaching because of the professional degree that they actually have regarding it, or licensing, I should say. So anyhow, that's just a side note. But I do have a question about like particular barriers. Were there any barriers that you faced in your career?
Absolutely.
Okay. Sometimes when it comes to barriers, it could be like kind of like a touchy subject. So what are you able to share when it comes to any barriers you may have faced?
Yeah, I think I would say the biggest barrier, and one I still struggle with, is kind of getting out of my own way and being sure of the path that I've chosen for myself. So when I graduated, the Great Recession happened a couple years later, and just journalism was looking really bleak and newspapers were laying off so aggressively. And it was tough to really find my footing. And a lot of places were looking for different skills than, than I had anticipated. But I always knew in my heart of hearts that journalism was what I wanted to do. And I, you know, I did use that time to try different things and I deviated a bit, but I always came back to it. And now that I look back on it, I feel like I wish I just listened to my gut, and I wish I wasn't afraid of what I saw happening in the industry, because I was young and I had time and space. And, you know, not like now where I have many more responsibilities where I can't, you know, I can't, there's just certain choices I can't make right now and moves I can't make, but I could have done then because my needs were so much lower. So I guess I just wish I didn't squander some time on the front end. And, you know, I wasn't afraid, and I listened to myself and said, okay, if reporting is what I want to do, then let's just do reporting and ride this wave and figure out how this industry is changing and how I can change along with it.
Yeah, I think getting in your own way is a is a universal challenge. When it comes to getting in your own way, do you have a solution for that now these days? Like, is there a way, is there anything like a process that you go through or just try to be more confident? Like, what do you do?
I go to friends who know me really well and can remind me of, you know, who I am and why I'm here and not to get discouraged. And, you know, just kind of remind me of my core values. So that's one, just having a really solid friend group and / support group. And when I'm not stressed, I try to remember the places that bring me joy. And
so good.
Then figure out like, okay, like for example, I love writing. I love trying to create pictures through words and helping people feel connected. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to do journalism. So, okay, if that is my like core need for work, like, you know, I gotta stay true to that.
What exactly is investigative reporting? Like, can you explain how it differs from other types of journalism?
So investigative reporting is journalism that goes very deep on a particular topic. And it seeks to uncover the truth about that topic or issue. It's often focused on a systems failure or some type of government, corporate, some type of wrongdoing that is happening. And reporters at all levels can pursue investigative reporting. The work that we do at the Center for Public Integrity, we're not a daily journalism outfit. That's, you know, our bread and butter is investigative and longer form projects. And a lot of that work is focused on data and documents, analyzing data and documents. So we file a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests with federal agencies to try to understand whatever issue it is that we're looking at better. And I'm very fortunate to have work with data reporters and who can access and look at these huge data sets and ask questions of this data. But I think investigative journalism differs from other types of journalism in that it zooms out and tries to see the big picture. It's slower. It's not about the day-to-day or like the individual like play-by-plays. It's more like, okay, what does all that mean? What is the big picture here? What is the takeaway? And what is the pattern that we're seeing here?
Yeah. So it's not that breaking news scrolling at the bottom of the screen. Mm-hmm. It takes some time to identify patterns and uncover, you know, system failures. That makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. So then when do you know that you have a story? Like I would imagine as you're looking at data, looking for patterns, at some point you realize, oh, I have something here. Like, what is that for you? How do you know when you have a story?
So for me, it is finding some of those patterns. It is just being able to spend a lot of time with an issue. You understand it really well. But also it can be good sometimes to just bring fresh eyes to it. Somebody can see like, hey, that thing, like that doesn't make sense. And being able to explain that in a clear way and try to get answers around it. We just finished a podcast at CPI called The Heist, and it's focused on...
Yay!
Thank you. Yeah, it was a journey.
I do want to get into that. This is probably a good time to do that. Tell me about The Heist and this particular season.
Yes. So it's a 5-episode podcast and it is focused on Black farmers and the long documented history of discrimination that they faced with the Department of Agriculture. It is largely focused on a man, a rancher, a Black rancher in Oklahoma named Nate Bradford. And he is based in one of the old Black towns in Oklahoma called Boley, one of the 13 remaining historic Black towns in eastern Oklahoma. And, you know, basically he's trying to make it as a rancher. He's younger. He's in his mid-40s now. And it's difficult because in some ways that history of government discrimination looms over him. You know, there are ways that the Biden administration now is trying to correct for that discrimination, faces its own challenges in doing that. And industry, just agriculture, has changed so much where it's very difficult to be a small player like Nate.
Yeah, I could see that. It's almost like the, well, this is not the same, but I'm thinking of it in terms of how you have the mom and pop shops. And then now you've got the big box stores, which makes it harder for them to compete. In every way, the bigger corporations, or whether it's Amazon making it harder for local bookstores to thrive, just seems like the bigger corporations in many facets of life make it harder for the smaller entity to thrive. So it's interesting that that's also happening to ranchers.
Yeah, absolutely. Nate likes to call it the Walmartification of agriculture. Where he says, you know, now to make it, you have to be able to do every part of the process, where ages ago, you only had to do one thing really well. And I think that applies to a lot. I mean, I can apply that to journalism too, where one only had to be a reporter, but now we're doing podcasts and we're doing social media and we're doing videos and so on. So, you know, he argues it makes it so much harder for small guys like him to compete. And a lot of the government programs are more, you get subsidies and they pay more to farmers who have more land, which is going to be, Black farmers are so small anyway, but it is still going to be largely white farmers. And then farmers who are bigger often get larger subsidies.
Yeah, I participated in a civil rights tour through the South. I've done it a few times with an organization. And one of the years we went to, I think we were in Mississippi when we were able to speak with a rancher. And it was just basically explaining, like, one of the difficulties is like getting a loan approved on cycle. Like, it's like, if you don't get the money on time, you can't really, you know, have your crops. So it's a challenge that he was explaining that had a direct impact on his operation. And then also for him, also having children who were not interested in necessarily continuing the business and not wanting to lose the land. Mm. But if you don't have anyone who wants to carry on that legacy, it makes it extremely challenging.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's something that a lot of elder Black farmers at least talk about, because their children saw the really hard challenges that they had to go through and are saying, nope, I don't want any part of that.
Opt out of this. how can I opt out of this? Mm-hmm. So for you, how did you know that this was a story that you wanted to investigate?
So I had started reporting on rural issues about 5 years ago. And as a subbeat for that, I started looking at agriculture. And then that led me to learning more about government discrimination against Black farmers. And through talking with farmers, I learned about Pickford versus Glickman, which was this landmark class action suit where Black farmers took the government, USDA, to court and won, although it was problematic, which is a whole other conversation. But through learning about that history, and then now with the Biden administration trying to make efforts to correct for past discrimination, it started a debt relief program earlier in the administration that was trying to relieve the debts of farmers of color. And that effort faced challenges in the courts and ultimately had to be put on hold. And Congress essentially replaced it with another program that is for all farmers, regardless of race, and provides some measure. It's very different, but it's
not targeted.
It's not targeted, and it's just a very different program that provides some measure of debt relief. So all of this stuff happening now, and that history of discrimination that is often largely centered on loans, told me that I wanted to look at discrimination and lending and tell this story about Black farmers today.
Did you find any things like, oh my gosh, I totally want to like go down that rabbit hole, but I got to stay focused. Like, did you uncover? Because I would imagine, like, when you're investigating something, you might stumble upon other things, other avenues that you want to explore further. Did you have that happen to you at all during this?
Yes, I did. I'd like to look more at subsidies and being able to really understand the disadvantage that Black farmers and other farmers of color have around the subsidies that they get from the government, and the historical underpinnings of that, that's, I mean, it's all very, very complicated. So it's kind of over there for me right now. But that is something that I'd really like to delve into deeper.
So for students who want to travel down a similar path and do investigative reporting, for you telling this story, like what's involved in bringing it to life? Like, is there a crew? Is there, you know, you and a recorder? Are there like other, like, I don't even know what type of questions to really ask about this, but like what is involved in telling this story and bringing it to life?
There's so much involved. Oh my goodness.
So maybe not everything, but like what are the top things? Because I know, like you were saying earlier, how when you started journalism, you know, there's this idea that you just be essentially focused, not like a generalist in terms of like being able to do all these, wear all these other hats, you know, having a podcast and do video. So like what's involved? Maybe like three other things.
Well, so for bringing a story like this to life, it's first having a really good understanding of the system. You have to understand the system really well and spend some time doing that. So you're probably writing stories, just other stories about very, you know, different related topics that you don't know where they're taking you, but they will ultimately help you step back and say, oh, connect the dots and say, oh, you know, I think I want to ask this bigger question and pursue this as an investigative story, potentially. Because then you need to see, okay, well, here is my question. How can I answer that question? What resources do I have at my disposal to do that? What data can I access to be able to answer this? What documents available are there to answer this? Can I get those data and documents in a timely manner? And you try to get those things, access those things, and see what they tell you. For us, we work very collaboratively at CPI, and we have data reporters that we work in partnership with to, you know, be able to navigate a story like this. We have an audience engagement team that is working alongside you throughout the process and thinking about, okay, what is the best way for our audience to understand this topic? And what are the tools that we can use to help bring the story to them? And sometimes that can be, you know, it's often there's staples like social media and different spaces to share the story, but sometimes it can be having a live event with people from the community and the journalists, or it could be tapping into different groups on the ground and, you know, asking them what they need and seeing what questions they have and trying to do something that is a bit more solutions oriented. So there's that. And then there's also just the elements like photos and videos and other multimedia. There's editing. There's an editor who is editors, you know, really overseeing the project and asking you questions throughout. And you're having to rewrite some more. And then there's fact checking that happens in-house through an attorney who is our fact checker. And then also, depending on the story, we have another attorney who's on contract with us who makes sure that everything is tied up correctly also. So there's a lot of people involved throughout the process.
Yes, that is very, that's a lot of people. It's a whole machine.
Yeah.
That's a lot. So when you were talking about documents or things, resources that you want to access as part of the story, and you know, can I get them in a timely fashion? It makes me wonder, like, how long did it take to actually do the heist?
It took a bit more than a year. It wasn't the only project I had going on, or any of us had going on, but it took more than a year. And I had some leave, about 3 months of leave in there too. So it was a very long process. It was a journey, like I said.
So how do you know when you're finished? I don't know. Does the story tell you that it's done? Or does the budget tell you that you're done? Does the access to people tell you? Like, how do you know when you're finished?
I think other people might answer this question differently. But for me, I feel like yeah, those things, like you got a deadline, this has to go, we're done here. But in a lot of ways, it feels like the story is never quite finished, because it can always, you know, things always happen. And like you said, questions come up and other stories come up that you want to, whose paths you want to follow that could be useful. But at some point, you know, there's a deadline and you just have to move on.
When you're developing the story and you're interviewing people and you're involved with the community, like, how do you build a rapport with those people? Sometimes, I don't know, I'd imagine that some people don't necessarily want to talk into a microphone. Like, how do you build a rapport during that interview process?
I mean, in the beginning, you're not, like with Nate, for example, I was trying to find people that we could potentially focus the podcast around. And he kind of knew that, but I mean, I don't know how much depth I went into at the outset. I was really just trying to understand him better and see what he could share about his own story and see what documents he had to confirm and verify some of what he was telling me and to what extent he was willing to share that. I tried to listen to him and listen to what he thought was important and ask questions so that we could build trust. I talked to other folks who were around him, like family and other people in the community. I always try to just aim for understanding in my work, especially for something like this, where we do have time to build those kinds of relationships. Ideally, you're already working in this space, so you're already aware of some of the key sources and you've already interviewed those folks and have a relationship with them before you're trying to do a podcast.
Yeah. So what did April Sims, investigative reporter, learn during this process? What did you learn?
Oh my goodness. I learned a lot. I'd never hosted a podcast before. I dabbled in some audio reporting. I mean, dabbled reporting and production, but that was a big learning experience in itself, just being out in the field reporting for audio. Reporting is the same, but you do phrase questions a bit differently to get a response that's going to work for audio. So there was a lot of learning that happened with that. And I'd filed requests for freedom of information before, but not so many. So there was a lot of learning that happened just in filing those requests. And I was very fortunate to be working with a data reporter on that. So we tag teamed on that. I learned a lot more about this agricultural policy and, you know, what we call source building. So building that trust and rapport with folks on the ground like Nate, and some level of project management, because there are so many moving parts and pieces to keep track of. And at the end, it gets super intense when everything is getting ready to get published. So I learned some about project management as well.
So what impact has the story had on the issue that you're aware of so far?
I mean, I hope it's helping people feel seen and heard. So I hope it's helping folks who feel like their challenges haven't been given much of a spotlight have now, and that there's a greater understanding of it. I hope that this work is also reaching folks who may have never thought about the plight of Black farmers and decided, oh, I want to continue learning about this. So I hope it's building that curiosity and awareness as well.
So of all of the work, your entire body of work, what work has made you most proud?
I struggle with this one. Everything I've done is so different. Like, I like some of the longer form stories I've been able to do because it's just fun to be able to really go deep on a project and bring your voice, your writing voice to it, and play with scenes and help people, hopefully. I mean, the goal, at least, it's to help people feel like they're in that place. And so, I mean, I've done some work internationally. I did a story in Eastern Congo some years ago, and I was proud of that. That was a lot of fun. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. But I don't know. Everything is so different.
So with that Eastern Congo project, what was it about it that ranks up there as being, you know, a proud work that you take pride in?
I mean, when I think back on it, I'm like, whoa, I don't think I would go to Eastern Congo today. I don't know. It feels, I don't know. It's really amazing. And I'm so fortunate to have had that experience and to have been able to go to Virunga National Park. And we went gorilla trekking. That's like, wow, I can't believe I had that experience and got to write about it. And at the time, there were a lot of militia groups. I don't know what the status of the country is in now, but at the time there were a lot of militia groups in North Kivu, but the UN had taken over basically, and it was the safest time to go. This was about 10 years ago. Mm. And that's when we went. And I don't know that I'll ever go to a place like that again. But now I have a family. I don't know that I would be able to go to a place like that again.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not just those independent decisions. Like, I get it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I want to talk about a little bit about being overwhelmed, because you talked about deadlines and just all the different things that are involved in bringing a story to life. So do you ever experience feeling overwhelmed?
Oh, yes. All the time. So much.
All right. So what do you do to handle stress?
Oh, I'm working through this. I'll say I often will do work on the weekends, so I try to not do that. I try to decompress a lot of times I'm consuming things that are helpful to my work. So whether it's like a podcast or a movie, I'm thinking about work. So I try to just watch things that are silly and, you know, or romantic comedies that have never typically been my go-to, but at least it's like, it's not about work, right? Or I'm not learning something in service of whatever it is I'm writing about. So I try to do things that are light, try to get outside. I'm trying to do better with hobbies. Cooking I have to do, but I kind of enjoy it and I've gotten better at it. So that's actually become a bit of a release for me.
Okay. Yeah, I can relate with the romantic comedies, the rom-coms. That was not at all a genre of film that I ever liked or enjoyed. But I have found myself within the past 2 or 3 years really enjoying not just rom-coms, but they're like Christmas rom-coms. I have no idea why, but it seems like that starts to put me in the Christmas mood. And I've just really started to enjoy them. So yeah. I binge watched a couple years ago just on Netflix. It's like, oh, here's another Christmas one. Oh, here's another Christmas one. Oh, here's another Christmas one.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, binge watching shows, my go-to is Jane the Virgin. I love Jane the Virgin.
So I didn't even know that show like came on like regular network television. I didn't discover it until it was on Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Same here.
And I think I binge watched, I don't know if it was like the first 2 seasons, but I really, I'm like, this is actually pretty good. I really enjoyed it.
I love it. Whenever I need a laugh, like I go to Jane and I binge watch Jane.
Yes, yes. So I just want a take on like your personal style. So if you were designing a support system for journalism students, what would it include?
I think having folks at different levels who can, you know, who are willing to hear you and guide you and tell you the truth when you need to hear it too. So, I mean, I'm very fortunate. I have folks who are, you know, retired journalists who I can go to and talk through things with. I have friends who are not journalists who I can talk through things with and give me a different perspective. And I also try to not talk about journalism with. I try to like set it aside like have a bit of distance from it as well. I think all those things are really helpful. Having hobbies and investing in them, because it's so easy to just get consumed in the work. But I do think like younger people are so much better about having boundaries for themselves and taking self-care seriously. So I appreciate that. Yeah, I think all that stuff, getting a good night's sleep, all that stuff can be helpful.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a generation that prioritizes self-care, prioritizes vacation, mm-hmm. prioritizes like all the things that I have felt in the past that I've got to try to like squeeze in, make time for. It's like, oh, they're just living the life. they're living the life. And yeah, I could sometimes wonder, are you also working or are you just living life? But anyhow, I'm not kidding. That won't go into that. I saw that you had been doing some mentoring at some point with the journalism. My question is, like, if you were going to teach journalism to students, if you were going to teach like the April Simpson technique of investigative reporting, what would be like the top three rules? Like, you must do this, you must do that, and you must do this. Like, what would be your top three rules?
I think learning the art of interviewing is really important, because it is an art and it's hard. I mean, you're dealing with all different types of people, but it's important to know how to do more of an accountability interview. Or at the other end, it's important to know how to talk to and interview someone who does not know much about journalism and media, where you have to really hold their hand and walk them through it and make sure that they are very aware, especially if it's someone who has experienced some level of trauma, they are very aware mm-hmm. of what they are sharing, the potential ramifications of it, you know, where it is going to be shared, like really, really break it down. So I think just interviewing and one, two, understanding the source and how to deal with government officials all the way down to just regular people and people in very vulnerable circumstances. Those two things are really important. And learning and appreciating and working in partnership with your audience and thinking about them every step of the way. And, you know, taking a step back and asking yourself, like, what is the best way for this reporting to be consumed? And how can we go about doing that? What is the best tool at our disposal for making sure the story reaches the people that we're really trying to reach, so that, you know, it's not a long form investigative story that sits on a website, but people who you've written about in a place that has little or weak internet access doesn't actually see the story. It's finding ways to make sure the story gets to them. And maybe the story is not, you know, a 3,000 word story. Like, maybe that's not the story that they need to be, that is for them. Like, maybe there's another way to tell the story.
I always like to ask people this question, and it is, in what way are you impacting the lives of others?
I hope I'm helping, like I said, people feel understood, seen, heard. Hope I'm building bridges in a way. So people who, I mean, that's what also drove my interest in journalism, like moving from a place that was so different, you know, outside New York City to a very small town with its own history and not really understanding that as an 11-year-old. I try to bring historical context into my work so that people hopefully get like, what is underpinning the issue or topic that we're talking about? That this thing didn't just happen. Like, no, there's a whole history to this thing. And I hope it informs someone's thinking about it. Like, it may not, I'm not trying to, you know, change minds, but at least like build more education around the issue. I mean, especially now where I cover racial equity and inequality is such it's such a focus point right now.
Yeah.
But, you know, people don't always understand that the inequalities that we see are rooted in issues that are longstanding. We can look at, you know, things all the way going back to the 60s and even before that, that are systemic problems that are still facing us today and haven't been fixed. So I hope my work is helping to bring greater levels of understanding.
All right. My final question. There's journalism students who are going to be graduating this year. What advice do you have for them?
Try to build your audience or build your brand, as they say. Don't be afraid to, whatever it is you want to be doing in journalism, like whether it's writing or taking photos or audience engagement, editing data, like whatever it is, do it and share it with the public and, you know, try to build an audience around it and figure out what does that audience need from you and try to serve them. So start a newsletter sharing your work or talk through the things that interest you on social media. Network like crazy and don't be afraid to follow up with people. Find the local chapter of a national journalism group. Like, I'm a member of the National Association of Black Journalists. There's Hispanic journalists, Asian American journalists, Indigenous journalists. There's the Society for Professional Journalists, Online and News Association, LGBTQ plus journalists. Like, there are all sorts of journalism organizations. And they're very, very helpful, especially for early career journalists. So, you know, find the local chapter, go to their events, talk to people, ask questions. Folks are very helpful. If you can afford it, go to the national conferences and just, you know, talk to people. And if you feel called to leadership in those organizations, like, go for it, volunteer. Some of these conferences actually have organized student journalism projects. So if you're a student, you can apply and cover the conference where they'll have like a conference.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like it's cool, like a conference newspaper, or they'll take over one of the TV channels at the conference hotel and the broadcast journalism students will be giving the news of the conference for, you know, folks at the hotel. And, you know, it's cool. So it's a great opportunity to learn and to network. If you have to take a full-time job outside of journalism to pay the bills, like, do that. But to the extent that you can, make sure you have time and space to be doing journalism outside of that job until you can get that full-time job in journalism. But ultimately, like, don't get discouraged. Don't give up. It's really hard. Like, it is very hard starting out. But if you keep plugging away, like, you'll find a path that's right for you. But be patient because it's going to take time. It might take years, but you'll get there.
Well, thank you so much for coming to the Academic Survival Podcast, April. I think that journalists do important work. I have heard the phrase that journalism is the fourth branch of the government, you know, just making sure that people are held accountable, making sure that truth is being told. And we are living in an age where truth is being confused with what is not true. It is, in many cases, being hidden, being buried. And it's important that there are some truth tellers out there that are looking for stories that we would not ordinarily see on our own, but bringing those stories to life. So thank you for the work that you do. And thank you for sharing your story on the Academic Survival Podcast, because I believe it will help future journalists.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for your great questions.
That's it for today on Academic Survival. If you want to share your story on how you survived your freshman year of college, you can reach me at info@chandralmcdonald.com. We'll be back next week with more ways to survive your academic journey. Until then, happy studying.